These days, everyone who has a mobile device can take great photos and shoot videos, showing up all the time on Flickr, Instagram, Facebook, and a host of other social media sites. You point your phone and shoot a picture. Sometimes it's a hit, and many times it's a miss. So what separates the amateurs from the pros? For over 125 years, Dodd Camera has assisted photographers, both professional and amateur, with state-of-the-art cameras, lenses, lighting and darkroom equipment, and class instruction. You can learn about new equipment from their blog or attend one of the many in-store events. The folks at Dodd Camera are helpful, professional, and experienced. They'll take the time to answer your questions and give you advice you can use. You may go to doddcamera.com to find out more. And finally, we wish to thank Dodd Camera for sponsoring the Outspoken Cyclist podcast.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for February 24th, 2018. As you know by now, our show is sponsored in part by Health IQ. I've been telling you about the company and the work that it does to seek out reduced life insurance rates for health-conscious people like us for a few weeks now. This week, I spent some time on their website, reading some of their testimonials, and I really appreciate the variety of responses and the reasons folks consulted with Health IQ, even though some of them chose not to take advantage of their services. Life insurance can be a testy subject, and one that still needs to be addressed by most of us. If you are thinking about a new policy, replacing the one you have, or you just want to know about the special rates that Health IQ can negotiate for you, take a moment, log on to healthiq.com/TOC. Your good habits and lifestyle can pay off big time. So remember, healthiq.com/TOC. Get a free quote to see if you qualify for lower life insurance rates. So I do have one more plug before we move on to this week's show. Radiothon. Yes, it's time for Radiothon. To those of you who have already pledged your support, I send out a huge thank you. If you were planning to help support the show, don't wait. Do it now. Log on to wjcu.org. Click the Radiothon pledge button, and the simple form will appear like magic. If you'd prefer to give your information to a live human being, you can call 216-397-4438, and someone will take your pledge over the phone. Any amount is most appreciated. And remember, what's pledged to the station stays with the station. All of it. Radiothon officially ends tomorrow, February 25th, but we will keep the form online until midnight of the 27th. So as we move on to this week's show, I want to say first that we just couldn't have two more contrasting conversations. Design architect Sarah Morcos works for Walker Consultants in Boston. Walker is the world's leader in parking design, and Sarah's interest particularly is in incorporating bicycle parking into those designs. In an article she wrote for the Walker website, Sarah talks about the challenges of bicycle parking, and I thought we could ask her to share them with us. We also talk about the company's big upcoming project that needs to park over 5,000 cars and 3,000 bikes. Wait till you hear how they're going to accomplish this. After a break, where I will probably mention Radiothon again, I have a lengthy conversation with Bob Howells. Bob is a writer, journalist, and co-founder of themastersathlete.com. a website dedicated to middle-aged people who live and love active lives. That would include many of you listeners as well as me. Last week, his partner, dear friend, and outdoors writer Andrew Tillen was hit and killed as he changed a flat tire by the side of the road while on a group ride in Austin. Bob and I talk about Andrew, their relationship, the work they've done, and what an amazing man Andrew Tillen was. We delve into Bob's work, which includes a gig with SpaceX, his passion for our national parks, and finally where things will go with the MastersAthlete.com work. So first, let's head off to Boston and speak with parking design architect Sarah Morcos. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it is my pleasure. You know, we've done many segments over the past few years talking about how cities are changing as the need and even the desire for cars is becoming less important to the younger generations. And then cycling infrastructure is a big topic that we talk about on the show. Tell us a bit about your background in these areas.
Sure. So my role is a project architect here at Walker Consultants. We're the world leaders in the design of and restoration of parking garages. At Walker, we've seen the demand and interest in bike parking rise over the years. We've been looking at different ways to best integrate bike parking within garages while providing a high level of service for all users. So in addition to that, I have a personal interest in bicycle parking because I myself rode my bike for years for both leisure and commuting. I watched bike riding completely take off in the Boston area over the last 15 or so years, and I've also watched the struggles of safely and securely providing this new thing for bicycle parking.
Well, going through your website, and there's a really interesting article that you wrote about bicycle infrastructure in terms of parking, both inside and outside. I found it very interesting that there are so many options. You would only think there'd be a few. What kinds of challenges have you encountered when you're working with clients who obviously want to maximize their dollars when building a parking structure? If they're charging for parking and bicycles, it's hard to charge the same thing for a bicycle that you do for a car.
Right. So if you evaluate a parking structure as a total number of square feet and divide it by the maximum number of parking spaces, sure, you would be losing some revenue there. But many owners look at their garages holistically, meaning if it's a shopping center, you're broadening your client base by providing bike parking. If it's an office center, university, or transportation hub, you're reducing the demand for vehicle parking by allowing workers to use different modes of transportation. At apartment buildings, it's a selling point because you're providing options for residents. As for parking garages that are public, that are intended solely for the revenue collection, one option to consider is providing paid bicycle parking. I know it's not a beloved topic among cyclists, and I kind of go back and forth on it myself, but if we want equal parking, being open-minded to a fee may be a reasonable compromise. So if we think of the ratio of bike parking to vehicle parking being about one vehicle space for about 15 to 20 bike spaces, a parking space in a garage that would cost the vehicle $100 a month would cost the bike $15 to $20 a month. The advantage of doing so is having a safe and secure area to keep your bike for an extended period of time. So this is not for your short-term run-in, run-out kind of bike parking, but this is for parking your bike for the workday or overnight or something like that. Many universities implement this system, not just for revenue, but for security and accountability. Also, a lot of New York City public parking garages provide paid parking.
What you're saying is you can take the same amount of space that you charge a car $100 for, and you might charge the bike only a few dollars a month, but you're offering security, which I think is a really important thing. I know friends of ours who have ridden their bikes to work and they park underground under their, you know, in the spaces provided and lock the bike up and come back and find like their pedals are missing or their saddles are missing or something's, you know, somebody stole the rear wheel. I mean, really stupid stuff, but it happens. Whereas if it's in a garage, are you people guaranteeing some sort of security? Are they saying we're going to watch this and make sure that these things don't happen? Is that possible?
Well, so there's a few steps that you would need to take to provide an additional level of security. So ideally, in the design of bicycle parking and the layout within parking garages, I would take the following steps. I would separate the entry exit for cyclists from vehicles. I would secure the space, whether lockers, room, or cage, close to the entry so that the bicycle and vehicle traffic are not mixing inside of the garage. I would provide additional lighting in and around the space where bikes are being stored. I would provide security cameras and, if appropriate, locate it where an attendant has direct sight lines to it. And then there are a few other things that I would do from kind of an accommodation standpoint. But for security purposes, I would add a few levels of security than you might have for a regular parking area.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Sarah Marcos. She is with Walter Consultants in Boston, and she designs and has built parking garages and other parking structures for both cars and bicycles and probably motorcycles and other things. What are some of the solutions for retrofitting a structure? So let's say somebody already has a parking lot that's attached to his or her office building or whatever and has decided to offer more bike parking. What kind of retrofitting could be added to a space instead of just saying, okay, we're just going to take these four spots and mark them off for cycling? Are there other things that you do to retrofit an area for cycling?
Yeah, so we do this all the time. And it really all depends on how much parking is necessary for bicycles. As long as there is a flat, usable area close to entrances, we can retrofit to provide parking, whether it's wall-hung racks, inverted U's, bike cages, or lockers. Another option is providing an exterior pavilion adjacent to the garage. We've done this at university where there was no real good place for it, but they had this extra space outside, and we were able to design a bike pavilion that attached to the exterior to provide kind of a secure area for that bike parking. It becomes more challenging when there's no entry-level parking, and you're immediately required to go up and down. So sometimes you kind of have to get creative using elevators and things of that nature. But really, if there is a desire for it, we'll probably figure out what the best way for it is, keeping in mind that we don't want to take over large amounts of the vehicle parking that's already been provided.
Right. When we think about places like Cleveland, where you are not riding your bike quite a few months a year, and so that space becomes available, let's say, in a downtown area where you're going to commute in during the spring and summer and maybe even in the fall, but then you're not going to use the bike. Are there ways to take the biking places and make them back into cars, and then you have to take them away from the cars? Or how do you work that out?
Yeah, so we haven't had many implementations of this, but this is something that Walker has been studying as we face this challenge in many climates with brutally cold winters and then, you know, moderate spring, summer, and fall. We've been looking at the idea of convertible parking, meaning parking that can be used during peak bicycle demand as bike parking and can be easily transformed back into vehicle parking during the winter months. So this type of arrangement doesn't allow for the caged or secure parking solution, but it does allow for flexibility as the demand soars and plummets. It's really kind of a compromise solution where when you see a lot of bike demand during those months, you can allow for this additional parking that can be taken away. So a back and forth kind of system.
How big is the demand for bicycle parking now? How much have you seen it change? I don't know how long you've been in this line of work, but let's say over the last 5 years or even, you know, less.
It's really, it's incredible how much it has taken off. And the view of clients have changed completely. So it used to be that, okay, well, we need to provide some bike parking. Let's put a little bit or a couple of racks in the corner of the garage where nobody will see them anyway and it doesn't matter, but we'll check a box off saying that we've got bike parking. And now clients come and they really understand that this is a very important mode of transportation that people actually use often, and they have expectations. And so it really becomes more of an integration into the parking structure that is understood by both the client and the user versus kind of just checking off this, okay, I've provided bike parking box.
Would you say that the percentage of projects you're working on do include bicycles these days?
Yes. So I would say somewhere between 50 to 75% of our projects involve some kind of connectivity or integration of bike parking. Out of those, about half have bike parking inside of the parking garage.
So I have a weird question. What's the most unusual project that you either are doing or have done that included bicycles?
We're currently involved in a large project in northwestern North America that includes about 5,500 vehicle parking spaces and 3,000 bicycle parking spaces.
Wow.
3,000, yeah. So due to the sheer volume of bike storage, the parking will actually be provided in automated silos throughout the development. So there's 10 to 12 silos throughout the complex. I've only seen these types of storage systems on YouTube, so it's very exciting to be involved in a project of this magnitude. And each silo will hold about 200 bikes. So it's a very exciting kind of new way of doing it. I mean, we've seen it in Japan and abroad, but we haven't seen a lot of it in North America. So it's kind of very exciting to be involved in this.
I have seen it. I have watched them. I've always wondered, what if something goes wrong? My bike is stuck underground for the next 100 years. No, I understand, but it's very cool. I know you wheel your bike up and I think you put it on a hook and the silo kind of sucks it in and it stores it and everything's done automatically. It's a really cool system. The only thing I can think of and the only place I can think of in North America that might be interested in that might be Portland, but I'm not going to ask you where your project is. So
yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interest around, especially in the western part of North America.
Sure, sure. I think it's really fascinating. So how long have you been doing this?
So I've been with Walker for almost 6 years, and I started really looking into bike parking about a year in. So I've been studying it for about 5 years now.
It's very interesting. You know, we always, and this is going to be a little bit off topic, but my husband and I always talk about how convoluted some surface parking lots are and how crazy they are. And I have a friend who swears they do that so that if somebody is shoplifting, the police can get them because they can't figure out how to get out of the parking lot. And I said, I don't think that's true. So I said I would ask you that question. Do you have any idea of why some of these surface lots are so convoluted the way they're built?
Usually it's based on requirements from the city that you can only have curb cuts in certain locations. And so you can only have so many entry exits. And from a convoluted standpoint, what's probably being done is maximizing the amount of parking. So whether it's angled spaces or 90-degree spaces, probably what's happening is that they're trying to provide the maximum amount of parking possible for that footprint. But I'm not sure about whether it's for police to have a little bit of headway or not.
Well, I said that I would ask, and I did. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for explaining what's going on. Walker Consultants is in Boston, Massachusetts. Sarah Marcos is a design architect who works on parking structures that include bicycles, and we're very happy that you do that. Thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
All right. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye. Sarah Marcos joined me from Walker Consultants in Boston, Massachusetts. They are a architect design firm that works on parking structures, and they include bicycles in a lot of their projects. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Hey, it's just another reminder to log on to healthiq.com/TOC. Take one of the quizzes and see if you qualify for a lower rate for your life insurance. Remember that healthiq.com is looking at your good habits to help negotiate great rates for life insurance. healthiq.com/TOC.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and it's off to San Diego to speak with journalist and author Bob Howells.
Hi, Bob. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thank you for joining me on the show today.
Hi, Diane. My pleasure.
Well, you know, I first want to extend condolences to you and all of Andrew Tillen's friends and family from all of us here at the station and in my cycling world. It's been a really, really hard week, I'm sure.
It has, and thank you so much. It's been a hard week and a hard time, but the outpouring from the world of cycling, from the world of outdoor journalism, from the world of the outdoor industry and public relations folks and the media has just been beautiful and touching, really beyond words. I know how touched this family is, and I am too.
Tell us a little bit about Andrew and about you and your relationship and how you met him, because it's an interesting story.
It is. Andrew and I go back nearly 30 years. When I was already a fairly established freelance writer, and Andrew was a young editor at a publication called City Sports in San Francisco. We worked a little bit there, and I think he not too secretly envied my life because I was a freelance writer, and I was out traveling and doing stuff. And woe be unto him, he kind of followed in my footsteps and became a freelance writer and editor himself. He also worked for Outside Magazine for a number of years, and we connected there. He was my editor there for several years, and we've just always stayed in touch through our journeys through life and through this crazy world of outdoor journalism, and commiserated a lot, shared our passion for the outdoors, particularly cycling and running, and hiking and backpacking. You know, it's so rare to have a really, really good friend who does exactly what you do. You know, we were both writers about these topics, writing for a lot of the same publications and sharing our passion for the outdoors and for fitness. And on top of all that, he was just a hugely big-hearted guy who was just so kind and generous to everyone who came around him. And I know that can sound like almost cliched tribute to someone, but in the case of Andrew, it was just so, so true.
You know, everything I've read, and there has been already a ton of stuff written, has said exactly the same thing, how kind and how generous and how genuinely interested in you and what you do he was. It's really disheartening that this had to happen. Are you comfortable about talking what did happen to Andrew? What do you know about the incident?
Sure, I can tell you what I do know. He was on a club ride. He lived in Austin, Texas, and was a very active an engaged member of a club in Austin. And they were out on their Saturday morning ride. I think it was like a 50-miler, and they were well into it. It was kind of a foggy, rainy morning, and as Andrew flatted. So he was off to the side of the road fixing his flat. And as you know how it is with club rides, several people stayed with him. They all always check to make sure you have everything, and people stay with you. It's one of the typical kindnesses of cyclists. So Andrew was fixing his flat, and as I understand it, a car, maybe going a little too fast, skidded out on a curve and hit another vehicle, a pickup truck. And that vehicle struck Andrew and another cyclist. And the other cyclist was injured, but not badly. Andrew was critically injured and died in the emergency room not too long later.
I understand there was a surgeon with the group who did his best to try to administer to Andrew, but it was just not going to happen. I know he has children. I know he, in fact, they're teenagers. And I know this is going to be a tough time. And before we sign off today, we'll make sure that people understand there is a fundraiser on GoFundMe for the family. You know, the outpouring usually is huge when it comes to the cycling community, especially for somebody like Andrew, who was so incredibly popular. I wanted to know if you want to share anything about him that perhaps hasn't come out in the pieces that have already been written this week. Is there something that people would find or that you found so endearing about him that's different from what from all the stuff we've been reading?
Oh, I'd have to give that. I feel like I can't do it full justice, but he was a goofball and had just a great sense of humor, an irreverent sense of humor. I kind of alluded to that in a tribute I wrote to him on the website that we shared called The Masters Athlete, when I said something like there was never a situation too grave or serious where Andrew couldn't make a joke. And I think about that from time to time during this whole situation. I sometimes think, what would Andrew be saying about all of this coming his way? I don't have the words for it.
Right. Or at least that we can say on the radio, right?
Yeah. I wish I could pull out a great anecdote for you. It's just not coming to mind right now, Diane.
That's fine.
But you know, I think of all the times we stared at each other on Skype, because we live 1,200 miles apart. I'm in the Los Angeles area in Southern California. And, you know, I just picture a goofy smile and a willingness to laugh and engage at almost any time.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Bob Howells. He is the editor of The Masters Athlete, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. And we've been talking about his co-editor, Andrew Tillen, who was killed last Saturday in a bike crash. I don't really want to say. In this case, it almost was an accident because there was no animosity or intention. It was one of those freak things, it sounds like. But before I get to the Masters Athlete and your current work, you know, I did a little bit of sleuthing before I made the call today, and I want to explore a few of the projects in which you've been involved. And in fact, there have been a gazillion of them. Just credits too many to mention, but a couple of projects caught my eye. One was you worked on the SpaceX website. And because I'm an Elon Musk fan, I really would like to know about that. And then the other is you worked on a project about the myths about the national parks, a piece you wrote for the Washington Post. Can you tell us a little bit about just those two projects? And then we'll sort of just jump into a couple of others you've done.
The SpaceX project was just one of those things that I fell into. I actually saw that SpaceX was looking for some copywriting help, and through a friend of a friend, Diane, I've been around journalism for a long time, so I have friends almost everywhere. I was accepted for the project, and I wrote SpaceX's website and press kit. That was about 5 years ago, I believe it was. So the website has evolved some since then, but it was an overhaul of the website at the time. And I spent about 6 weeks in their offices, met Elon, who's an interesting guy. I'm an Elon Musk fan, too. I think that he is one of these people who just doesn't accept no for an answer, who believes that anything is possible. And he makes it happen, and he makes it happen quickly. So I have tons of admiration for Elon, and it was a great project to do. I also ended up writing about the Falcon Heavy for Popular Science, and the Falcon Heavy is that massive, actually three rockets that went up just a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow, wait a minute. Were you right there? Did you get to see it go up?
No, oh. I wasn't there. it was launched at Cape Canaveral.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But one of the very, very cool things about working at the SpaceX offices is that if you worked in the offices, you had a pass to go walk the floor. And SpaceX does virtually all of their own manufacturing and tooling right there on the premises in this huge, it's understating it to say it's the size of an airplane hangar. It's the size of many airplane hangars. So all the rockets, the components, these massive, massive pieces of machinery, so incredibly finely tooled, are right there to look at. And so I spent many hours just walking the floor, ogling these products, these amazing, spacey gizmos. That was really something.
I'll bet. I read a book about Elon Musk, and I just have to say, there are not a lot of visionaries the likes of him. So I'm really envious, Bob, that you got to actually meet him and spend some time in his factories, because I understand his facilities are really incredible, really incredible.
They are.
Yeah. So what about the national parks piece, the myths about the national parks? What did the Washington Post commission that piece about?
That was at the time of the government shutdown in 2013. And I've written about the national parks my whole career. National parks are a passion of mine. I absolutely love the national parks. Like so many American kids, I visited national parks with my parents. I remember going to Yellowstone and Crater Lake and Sequoia with my parents on camping trips when I was a kid, and just always been a huge national parks fan. And much of my writing career has been in travel journalism, and a lot of it about national parks, including I was a contributor and contributing editor to a couple of National Geographic books on the national parks. One's called Secrets of the National Parks, and the other is the National Geographic Guide to the National Parks. I've written chapters for both of those. So the Washington Post had me on their radar and asked me to do an opinion piece during the government shutdown about the importance of national parks. So that's how that came about, and that's what that was. And, of course, I was pretty upset that the government shutdown resulted at that time in the closure of the national parks.
Well, and now they're talking about doing things like drilling and defunding some of the national park systems. Yeah, it's very disconcerting. We happen to have a national park here in Northeast Ohio. It was the last act of President Gerald Ford before he left office, was to make the Cuyahoga Valley National Recreation Area the Cuyahoga Valley National Park.
Yeah, and I think that's it's wonderful that there are some in the Midwest, because they tend to cluster more in the West. And Cuyahoga Valley, you have a wonderful bike trail there, right?
We do. We have several, actually. Are you talking about the towpath trail, the Ohio Canal?
Yes.
Yeah, Erie Canal. Yeah, we ride it all the time. It's really nice. Yeah. And it's finally going to connect downtown. Everything seems to take a lot longer than you think it's going to. And then when it's done, you're going, oh, look, we just did this. But it took 30 years or whatever, right?
But largely a success story, and maybe one in the making. And I do fear that this administration's contempt for public lands is going to affect maybe the future of your national park and all sorts of public lands. I'm sure maybe we don't want to go too far into this, but out here, new national monuments, Bears Ears,
right,
in Utah, and relatively new Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument are under threat, and the administration, the Department of the Interior, is opening those to exploitation, uranium mining. It's really, really tragic what's happening to public lands, not just national parks, but all public lands under this administration.
Yeah, it's very scary, actually. And most of the people I deal with, I talk to, I interact with, are all outdoor people. They don't want to see anything happen to these beautiful parks, and I certainly don't. It's very disconcerting. My husband's from upstate New York in the Adirondack Park, which is an interesting, it's not a national park. It's 6 million acres, and it's owned by the state of New York. But it's interesting how that park itself sort of has separated itself from this whole national park system. And in some ways is pretty still wild and pristine.
It is. It's a huge, huge park. People tend to forget about it because it's not a named national park. It's, I believe it's administered by the state.
It is.
And one reason it maybe doesn't function as a classic national park is that it incorporates small towns and communities throughout. I know it's a treasured resource for upstate New Yorkers and really all of the great Northeast. And fortunately, it seems to be out of the target range right now.
Right now. That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
So I'm going to take a left turn here and ask you to back up a little bit. You know, if you go to your website, which is your own website, Robert Earl Howells, and you look at what you do, it's just incredibly broad. How would you describe what it is you do and who you are? If you could do it in, like, let's say, a sentence. Okay, maybe two sentences.
My Twitter description simply says adventurous writer.
Oh, that's good. That's short and sweet.
It is, because I am. I'm an adventurous person, and I'm a writer, and really dedicated to the craft of writing, and unafraid to dive into almost any arena or any genre. So, yeah, if you look at my site, bobhowells.com, you'll see that I do advertising copywriting, marketing copywriting, website, content stuff. You know, a long career in print journalism and travel writing for Outside, for National Geographic Adventure and National Geographic Traveler, and of course, my own website, The Masters Athlete. So, adventurous writer, I think, sums it up. I'm just passionate about communication and certainly about the outdoors and the fitness activities I love, such as cycling and running.
So what haven't you written about that you still want to write about?
Wow. Question. I know I want to dive further into what I'm doing in the
Masters. Which we're going to talk about. We are going to talk about the Masters Athlete in the second half of our conversation, which is fine. Yeah, but is there any publication, is there any topic that you have not touched upon that sort of is out there that you're saying, ooh, I want to do that?
I think it would probably be more advocacy journalism for exactly the topics we've just been touching on a little bit about public lands. My approach to public lands writing has largely been a sort of homage to public lands, writing as a travel writer, my passion for, my appreciation for the beauty of the outdoors, for places like Yosemite and Joshua Tree out here, places that I dearly love. And I've mostly approached them as a travel writer. I think that the next step for me is to kind of unholster my weapons a little bit and get into the advocacy aspect of them and do whatever I can to preserve public lands that are under attack.
All right, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back to talk some more with Bob Howells about the Masters Athlete. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit doddcamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We're back, and if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Bob Howells. He is the editor of the Masters athlete. He and Andrew Tillen, if you didn't hear the first half of our interview, go back and listen. He and Andrew Tillen co-founded the Masters Athlete. It's a blog and a website that addresses health and fitness and training, more for active men and women in their midlife. And I'll raise my hand there. I'd venture to say that more than 60% of my listeners fall into that category. So tell us, what is the Masters Athlete?
Well, our tagline is tools and inspiration for lifelong fitness. And we decided that we wanted a platform to kind of not extol this age group, and I would call it 40 plus, no upper limit, you know, middle age and post-middle age, to extol, to inform, and to inspire people our age to either get in shape, learn more about fitness, or get in better shape and learn more about fitness, and also to profile people who do remarkable things in the outdoors and let that be inspiration to all of the rest of us. We felt that the publications that are out there, whether it's for women, such as Shape Magazine, or for men, Men's Health, Men's Journal, and Outside, which is for both men and women, all wonderful publications, but largely aimed at, I would say, you know, a sub-35 category.
Absolutely.
So, you know, six-pack abs and shiny, gleaming muscles and, you know, crazy exploits. And believe me, I'm a fan of all of those,
right.
But we felt that the middle age and post-middle age demographic was being neglected by the media. So we decided we wanted to fill that void, and we're doing the best we can.
Well, you know, one of the things you say right at the beginning of, if you read the about and read why you've put this together, it isn't about turning back the aging clock, which is kind of a relief. It's about starting where you are and moving forward. So, you know, a lot of the people I know ride 2,000 miles a year, and they're healthy and they're happy and they're regardless of their age. But it's nice to sort of tell an audience that may not be there at this point that they can get there, that they can do these things. I teach yoga, and my students are 50 and up. You know, and I say, if you can sit down on a mat, you can do the work. And so yeah. I really appreciate what you're doing here.
Well, thank you, Diane. Yeah, I do think it's an overlooked cohort. And, you know, I think that advertisers, I mean, just look at television, you know, you can see how young. Everything is aimed at youth. And a lot of the stuff, even when it is aimed for a slightly older demographic, there's this notion that it has to be about anti-aging. And anti-aging, to me, is almost an insult. I'm proud of my age. I'm 64, and I'm proud of it. I've learned a lot. Andrew was 52. We both gained a lot of wisdom over the years, and we're proud of that. We're not against aging. We want to age healthfully and gracefully so that we can make the most of every minute of our lives. And that becomes all the more poignant when you realize that, like Andrew, life can be stripped away at any time. So we want to live it to the absolute fullest that we can.
So what are some of the things you are covering on the Masters Athlete? I know that you have news and you have stories and you have different writers who also share their stories. What are you incorporating into these stories? It's not just cycling and it's not just running. I mean, you have a lot of topics out there, like the 87-year-old mountain climber. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, one of Andrew's specialties was profiles of older athletes doing remarkable things, and we have a number of those on the site. We also investigate the latest health news so that we try to stay up on nutrition information and training information. For example, I believe Andrew did a piece recently for us just touching on something that we want to explore a bit more, that high-intensity workouts, which sound like anathema to most of us in post-middle age, are extremely important to those of us in post-middle age. Now, high intensity doesn't mean the same thing that a 30-year-old would do to train for a triathlon, but the importance of some interval training for those of us who actually generally kind of prefer to go long and slow. So we try to stay on top of cutting-edge information like that. Does that answer your question?
It does answer my question. I think there's a lot more to explore, but I'm going to tell people they should go out to the website and take a look around. What have you personally gotten out of the work that you're doing with TMA, the Masters Athlete? What have you taken away? What have you learned from all that work?
That's a great question. I, for one thing, remain constantly motivated. Not that I wasn't before, but I feel a quiet, unspoken obligation to walk the talk, you know, to take care of myself, to eat well, eat properly. And one thing that I've covered fairly extensively recently on the website is sarcopenia, which is the diminishing of muscle mass that really begins after age 30. And a small percentage of our muscle mass just goes away every year as we age. And unless we do something about it, i.e. do resistance training, that muscle mass is going to continue to diminish and result in challenges later in life. When we see elderly people who are frail and can't walk upstairs, tend to fall, barely get up off a couch, it's because they let their muscle training go. So that's something you asked what I've taken myself from personally from the work I've done. That kind of woke me up because I've always been a cardio athlete. I love bicycling. I love running. I love going for long hikes. Totally averse to going to gyms. I just hate weight training. So that woke me up a bit. I settled on a happy solution in the course of my research, which is to work with resistance bands.
Oh, like the TheraBand thing?
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
They come in all shapes and sizes and resistances. And I load them up in a backpack, a little day pack, and I can take them outdoors anywhere I want. So I do my weight training with resistance bands in the beauty of the outdoors and in the fresh air rather than go to a smelly, sweaty gym.
Or take the TheraBand and wrap it around a doorknob in the house, right?
You can do that.
Right, yep. But I mean outside, yep. I never even considered taking the bands outside. Of course, it's still cold and miserable here, so right now it's indoor. But
understood.
Yeah, but pretty soon. That's really interesting. I like that idea. So now what is next for the Masters Athlete? Where are you going to take it now, and are you looking for somebody else to sort of come on board to help you, or are you just going to, you know, take the reins and run?
Well, for now, I will take the reins and in Andrew's honor, do everything I can to keep the Masters Athlete alive and prospering. It's a mission that we concocted and shared and feel very, very passionate about. I certainly will welcome contributions from anyone who can contribute work of value to it. And hopefully this interview will help spread the word that we love good stories and good fitness and inspiration stories. And we welcome contributions to the website and to the newsletter. And eventually I probably will look for another partner because it's so valuable to be able to brainstorm and create and inspire one another, which
right.
I did all the
right.
time.
So just a couple more questions before I ask my three weird, crazy questions that I ask all of my guests who, when we get into this kind of depth in a conversation. And that is, is there a direction that the Masters athlete hasn't gone that you think you're going to take it? Is there any topic that is coming up now that you haven't yet covered?
There's a couple. The first that comes to mind is more combining fitness and travel.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, there's certainly an industry out there of fitness travel. You know, obvious examples are groups like Backroads or Butterfield and Robinson, the organized group tours that do bike rides and bike tours and hiking tours. And I want to bring more of that into the Masters athlete. And that certainly combines a couple of my personal passions, which is outdoor travel and fitness. So that's one direction I would like to take the Masters athlete. And apart from that, you know, just continue to dive into cutting-edge research, because I think one of the great things is that the world is slowly beginning to recognize that Gen X and boomers constitute a major, major purchasing and economic force. So we want to extol that and continue to investigate all the latest research that is aimed in our direction, so that we can continue to provide good and valuable and actionable information on the site.
Excellent. It's themastersathlete.com. So the last thing before I ask my questions that I want to mention, and that is that somebody graciously set up a GoFundMe campaign for Andrew Tillen's family. And it is GoFundMe.com/Memorial Fund for Andrew Tillen. He obviously is one of those people whose memory will remain just present for so many people. And I think if we can help out, we should.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you for that for that plug, Diane. And hey, Andrew was a freelance writer, and I think that the GoFundMe page will really, really help his family, and I greatly appreciate that.
So I will ask my three crazy questions before I let you go, and that is, what's your favorite food? And it doesn't have to be nutritionally perfect.
Oh, God, I'm so crazy there, because I really do like eating clean, healthy food.
Okay.
So broiled salmon, baked chicken, and turkey burgers. And they tend to cycle in our household. And I think those are they're good nutritional foods. And to me, they're wonderful and delicious. So that's my boring answer. My favorite treat is frozen yogurt.
Well, your regular favorite foods, those are pretty much in order. 1, 2, 3, what we eat in our house. So that's pretty interesting.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's the way we eat. My husband says to me, I could eat salmon 5 days a week. You know, and that's fine with me. What music do you enjoy listening to?
Okay, I'm a boomer.
Attaboy, me too.
Bruce and Dylan.
There you go.
There you go. I'll crank up Springsteen if I'm riding the bike path, or, you know, jogging a trail, and I'll have Springsteen going in my iPhone, and, you know, Bob Dylan rolls through town about once a year, and I always go see Dylan. Certainly many others, but they're at the top of my list.
Cool. And do you have any pets?
No pets.
Okay, that's interesting. I would have thought you'd be a pet guy. But if you travel, I know that's tough.
Yeah.
Well, geez, Bob, this has been such an interesting conversation, a lot of fun. It is themastersathlete.com. Bob Howells is the editor, and such a broad and interesting life you've led.
Well, thank you, Diane. Thank you. And it's certainly been my pleasure to be on your show.
Well, you have a wonderful day. Again, we are so sorry about Andrew, and it's GoFundMe.com, and go find the Andrew Tillen Memorial Fund and donate some hard cash to help this family, because, as you said, he was a freelance writer. I know all about that stuff.
Enough said.
Well, have a wonderful day. Thank you so much for taking so much time to talk with me today, and we'll talk again.
Pleasure, Diane.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bob Howells joined me from his office in San Diego. Please consider helping Andrew Tillen's family with a donation to the GoFundMe campaign. I'd like to thank Bob Howells and Sarah Morcos for joining me on the show this week. I actually have another request. Yep, it's a show just chock full of won't you do this for me's. Much of the content of the show comes from you, the listener. Even if I'm not able to cover every story that comes across my desk, I always try to follow up with at least an acknowledgement of the effort made to contact and enlighten me. So my request is actually twofold. If you have anything you'd like to contribute to the show in the form of a story or a book or someone you think would be an interesting guest, please send me an email at outspokencyclist@gmail.com. Secondly, the way more people find out about the show is through the podcast rating system that is part of your podcast download app. From clicking the star next to the podcast name in Apple iTunes to writing a review, for example, every interaction on the podcast site improves the chances that someone else will find the show and become a listener like you. So that's my spiel for tonight. Next week, it's a conversation with the amazing Katie Compton. Yep, that Katie Compton. And a chat with Leonard Zinn about his new maintenance book and about the latest experience he had with his heart condition. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Have a great week. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.